From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, America's two most colorful spin doctors put the spin on their own relationship. Mary Madeline and James Carville fell in love just before they went to work against each other running the Bush and Clinton campaigns. After the election, they got married and began writing their new book, All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. Also today, we phoned journalist Mark Danner in Port-au-Prince. He's been reporting from Haiti on and off since 1986. He'll describe the situation there now that the invasion has been averted. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Military officials say the American occupation of Haiti is going smoothly so far, with no resistance from the Haitians. President Clinton says the occupation force will work to make the country secure so democracy can be established. Many members of Congress say they're relieved that there won't be an invasion, but some are critical of the deal that averted bloodshed. The House and Senate are both expected to give formal approval to that agreement. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Members of Congress were briefed today by the president, the delegation, and military officials about the agreement reached in Haiti. Most expressed relief that American troops poised for invasion were entering the country in a different capacity. Some, however, continued to criticize the mission, saying American soldiers should not be put at risk to restore democracy with or without an agreement in place. House and Senate leaders expect to vote on resolutions as soon as possible to express support for the American forces currently in Haiti. Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn was a member of the delegation led by former President Jimmy Carter. He says his role was to convince the Haitian leaders that Congress would not block an invasion. Nunn said the military leaders were encouraged by speeches made on the Senate floor last week in opposition to military intervention. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Space Shuttle Discovery will not be landing today as scheduled. Because of bad weather in Florida, NASA is keeping the shuttle in orbit at least one more day. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Florida's late summer afternoon weather conditions proved to be too much for the Space Shuttle Discovery. Thick black clouds, which had been producing rain showers, forced NASA to postpone the landing until tomorrow. Mission Control had hoped that conditions would improve long enough to bring the shuttle home during one of two landing opportunities. Instead, the landing has been scrubbed, and the crew will now spend its 11th day in orbit. NASA will try again tomorrow with two chances to bring Discovery to Florida and two opportunities to send the shuttle to California, should the weather not cooperate at the Kennedy Space Center. Discovery is now scheduled to land at 2:11 Eastern Time tomorrow afternoon. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The UN Refugee Agency says the Bosnian Serbs seem to have expelled the last of the Muslim families living in the northeastern areas of Banja and Bijeljina. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the weekend purge appears to have swept the last 2,000 or 3,000 Muslims from the region. The Muslims have been left near the government-held city of Tuzla, except for some of the men. The refugees say the men are being held hostage until the government agrees to swap them for Serbs living in Tuzla. Red Cross officials say at least two people were killed in the purge. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than a point in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down nearly a point. This is NPR. O.J. Simpson's lawyers are arguing in a Los Angeles court today that some key pieces of evidence should not be allowed in his murder trial. They made similar motions at an earlier stage of the case, but were not successful. They want the judge to rule that police did not have valid search warrants when they collected a bloody glove from Simpson's property and blood samples from his driveway. Lawyer Robert Shapiro hopes that without those items, there won't be enough evidence to proceed with the trial. The prosecution counters that the police followed proper procedures and the evidence should be admitted. Simpson is accused of stabbing and slashing to death his ex-wife and her friend. Politicians from the Catholic and Protestant communities in Northern Ireland will be visiting the United States this week to court the administration and American public opinion. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
It's an indication of the increased role the United States government and public opinion are playing in the search for a peaceful settlement in Northern Ireland that leaders of all sides are trekking to Washington. John Hume, leader of the largest Catholic party in Northern Ireland, the SDLP, is in Washington today for talks with congressional leaders. Hume is a frequent visitor to the U.S. and is responsible for bringing much private American investment to the province. He will be looking to the federal government to add to the private money to help ease the province's transition to a new era. Later this week, members of the Protestant Ulster Unionist Party visit Washington for talks with top administration officials. They will urge caution in dealing with Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams, despite the IRA's ceasefire. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
37 mobsters went on trial in Sicily today, accused of the 1992 murder of Judge Giovanni Falcone, who was Italy's top anti-mafia fighter. The 37 defendants are accused of detonating a bomb as Falcone's car passed, killing the judge, his wife, and three bodyguards. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's two most colorful spin doctors are now husband and wife. After working against each other in the 92 presidential campaign, James Carville and Mary Madeline not only got married, they collaborated on a joint memoir that has just been published called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. Carville and Madeline started seeing each other shortly before he became chief strategist for the Clinton-Gore campaign and she became deputy campaign manager for President Bush. In fact, Madeline did her best to keep their relationship a secret until she secured her position in the campaign. She was afraid that she'd never get a high-placed position if she was regarded as consorting with the enemy. Earlier today, I asked Carville and Madeline if they thought journalists were more aware of and skeptical of spinning than they were in the 88 campaign, and if that made spinning more difficult.
I don't think it's different at all. I've been now involved in the last three presidential campaigns and campaigns before then, and we are not the rules makers. We are the games players. If the press tells us that, as they used to 30 years ago, there were a 42-second soundbite, we would comply with that. Today there's a 7-second soundbite, so we create 7-second soundbites. We have to work within the parameters that the media sets. The sum of what might have changed by degrees is that some of our quotes, comments, are more, let's say, colorful, to be charitable. And why is that? Because you can't break through. The press will not, if the president or the candidate's going to be giving the same speech over and over as he has to do to get his message out on the economy or whatever it is, and they won't cover it anymore. So part of our job is figuring out different ways to say the same thing and get the message out.
This kind of reminds me of in Casablanca when they said they were shocked that there was gambling going on. I mean, you know, public radio readers, listeners, let me share something with you. You may be shocked to know that when we work in campaigns, we fight as hard as we can to put our candidate in the most favorable light. Now, there's not
I'm shocked.
And so what happens here is we have the media, whose excesses have now almost reached a point of almost being ridiculous, blaming, quote, spin doctors. Well, for every quote that we have in the paper, a reporter called us and asked us to give one. And if you don't want to hear from campaign people or campaign spokespeople, call somebody else.
Mary Madeline, the Republican campaign, especially during one night at the convention, had an emphasis on family values, which you say was never really planned, that the family values emphasis was never really a pre-planned part of the campaign. Nevertheless, I find it really ironic that here you are directing the campaign. You're a very independent woman, divorced, living in sin part-time with James. It's a kind of a walking contradiction in a way of the family values a platform and the image of what a woman should be that some of the Republicans were holding up. And I wonder what you made of that.
I'm not really understanding the nature of this question. I mean, there are Republicans, there are Democrats, there are independents, there are non-voters who have just have their own view of how they want to run their lives. I don't check in on what people are thinking about before I run my life, which, by the way, I wasn't living in sin with James Carville before we got married. We never lived together.
Oh, you never lived together?
And I don't think getting a divorce in this day and age is any kind of something that one has to feel belies some sort of affection or approval of family values. What I said in the campaign was that to the extent that the media said that family values was a centerpiece of our strategy was wrong. And what I said critically of the campaign was that to the extent we ever talked about family, we never were able to describe how that translated into policy. And that our inability to define what family policy meant left a vacuum to be filled by what our definition wasn't, which largely was articulated by, at least in the media's eyes, by Pat Buchanan at the convention, which is not, I don't think, George Bush's view.
Well, did you try to... I'm sorry, James, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, my own view is I think the whole thing was good for us, and ultimately stupid for anybody to think that, you know, Pat Buchanan or Pat Robinson is going to, you know, by giving speeches. I mean, like I said in the book, you know, you can see somebody that, you know, that's gay saying, gee, I just got a speech from Pat Robinson and I think I'm going to change tomorrow. I mean, it's, you know, just that.
That was pretty gratuitous.
Yeah. But,
well, what's your point?
My point is just, I think the Republican convention actually ended up hurting the Republicans more than it helped them. I think that any time that government gets into this sort of thing about preaching about people, it tends to be more embarrassing than helpful in the long run. I mean, certainly in the short term, there's a political gain to be gotten by this, but I think in the long term, it ends up hurting more than helping.
And this from a guy whose president came back from Martha's Vineyard saying he had to change strategies and he was going to start talking about values. This from a guy whose president was quoting Dan Quayle. I concede in the book that how the press played out the Buchanan speech did not help the campaign. I also say there were 128 speeches. In addition to that, not the least of which were President Bush's, Phil Graham's, Lynn Martin's, Jack Kemp's, which didn't get nearly as much play. Was it a bad campaign event? Yes. Is it sort of hypocritical for you to sit here and say that the government shouldn't be preachy when your president has had his fair share of preachiness in the past 2 years, I think is gratuitous.
Well, again, be very clear. I mean, I think the president should talk about values, but when you sit up there and you say that we're in a religious war here, when you have sort of people like Pat Robinson there, when you have people like Jerry Falwell who are front and center in the convention, I think that's sending the very narrow message to the American people. But certainly I think the president ought to, you know, quote, talk about values.
You know, in watching you both during the campaign, I felt that in some ways you were both very similar. In other ways, you were incredibly different. Similar in the sense that you both seemed... very refreshing, very individualistic, very funny, you know, very quotable, but different in the sense of the kind of campaigns you were running. And let me explain what I mean here. I mean, James Carville, your emphasis on the campaign seemed to be, let's keep this very focused on the economy and healthcare and not allow the press to get us off into tangents. And whatever we're asked, we're going to refocus on what we think is the most important political message here. And Mary Madeline, a lot of times in the Republican campaign, you were giving very flamboyant quotes that were more about personality than about issues, things like calling the Clintons Clintonistas, sniveling liberal Democrats. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, let me say something.
Go ahead.
In as we are finding out now, sometimes it's different when you're the incumbent and you're the challenger. Mm-hmm. And I think what Mary was trying to do, I'm explain it as opposed to like, sometimes to be heard in a campaign, you try to put things out, and until you do things in a sort of a controversial way, mm-hmm. it becomes very difficult for them to be heard. And I think that what she was doing is she was fighting her heart out for her candidate. And I think that clearly what happened was that she was trying to do these things and it never got much attention. And what happens is that you have a situation where the media is not interested in something until it becomes controversial. And you have to be controversial to get your message out. It's kind of, and then when you become controversial to get your message out, you become creative. I mean, it's kind of you become criticized. So it's one of these kind of vicious cycles here.
What was not relayed about how I came to write sniveling hypocritical Democrats is that was part of a fax program where we sent out a fax a day, talking about something in Clinton's record that we thought he had misrepresented or something he said misrepresenting our record, preceding and started sometime in July. From January 7th until July, every single day, we gave to the press a so-called white paper, an erudite description of it, George Bush on this policy or something, and they never, ever, ever in 7 months used any of them. When you start, that's, as I said, somewhere along the line, then when you dress these things up, then they tend to, I didn't particularly want them to do the sniveling hypocritical Democrats, but that got them to read on. And many of those facts is the substance of what we were trying to get out, because they had fancy headlines or gripping or retching or sophomoric, whatever, juvenile headlines, caused the media to read on to the substance of the press release and many of the then observed flip-flops in the Clinton record or statements were subsequently reported because of that. Now, I don't make any apologies for it. And I think the suggestion, you were trying to suggest that mine was a more personal and ad hominem attack, and they really weren't. If you look at what they were, the substance of them had to do with Clinton's record and qualifications for president. And I am in no way apologetic for the way I work on campaigns.
You know what I think everybody really wants to know? When you're running a campaign, how much are the issues that you determine through polls or whatever would be effective issues for your candidate to talk about, and how much of it is really what the candidate stands for and what they told you they stand for and they want the campaign to be about?
A candidate stands for 50 things, 100 things. Who knows how many things? And somebody that runs for president, I mean, you know, George Bush probably been in public office of, you know, supposedly the best resume of anybody since World War II. Bill Clinton had been governor of a state for 12 years and given a gazillion speeches. I mean, they stand for so many things. Again, so much of what a good campaign tries to do is to sort of say, we have to pick two or three of the things that we want to articulate. And you can't, there's no way that you can communicate 50 or 100 things to the American people. It is impossible to do. No one has ever been able to do it. No one will ever be able to do it. So, as I say in the book, so much of our time is spent actually emptying full vessels as opposed to filling up empty vessels.
My guests are James Carville and Mary Madeline. They've collaborated on a new book called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Madeline and James Carville. In comparing both your strategies, I'd like you to both talk about when it became clear that there was a Bill Clinton letter, the letter you describe as the "thank you for helping me get out of the draft" letter. How did you both see that as an opportunity?
Well, I mean, when I saw it, my first reaction was, we got to publish this in a newspaper.
Yeah, now why did you think like it would be better for you to actually go with it yourself?
Okay, well, I mean, because at that time, if you go back, and that weekend, we were in sort of free fall.
Mm-hmm.
It was the worst weekend we'd had a campaign. And a lot of it was because of a story about a draft that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was on a Thursday before that, by Jeff Birnbaum. So when this came out, again, your instinct has got to be, the story is there, okay? The draft story is there. It's better to get in front of it, and it's better to use the letter to explain yourself. I thought the letter was a good thing because it was, intelligently written, and it sort of explained what was going on in a then-22-year-old's mind.
So what was the best way to get it out?
Well, we talked about it. We went on Nightline. We took out a full-page ad in the Manchester paper. We went on national TV. I mean, the decision is made to get it out. Getting it out is not that hard. We had a press conference with a bazillion people in an airplane hangar. I mean, we were on Nightline, and Ted Koppel read the entire letter on Nightline. We took out full-page ads in newspapers. We talked about it. We spun it, I guess you could say.
Now, Mary Madeline, did you see that letter as an opportunity for the Republicans?
Again, this incident occurred during the New Hampshire primary where, as we say in the business, never interfere with your enemy when he's in the process of destroying himself. We thought that the other Democrats would have a field day with it, and in fact they did. What we subsequently saw as an opportunity in the whole draft issue was the then governor's throughout as many campaigns as governor in Arkansas, had about just as many different stories of his draft status and his experience with all of that. And we thought of it as yet another example of inconsistencies in his, which doesn't matter if he's describing inconsistencies in his own life, but we saw that as something that was his policy formulation was replete with. But that was something that people could understand better than they could understand the to's and fro's of policy flip-flops.
Now, James Carville, you're working on at least two campaigns now, I think, Harris Warford
and Zell Miller.
And Amir Madeline, I believe you're not working on campaigns now, but I know you have your show on CNBC and you're a commentator on the Today Show. I guess, Mary, I'm wondering why you're not working on campaigns now.
Well, I'm campaigning for a number of candidates, as many as I can squeeze in just about every week, and I'll be on a campaign trip doing fundraisers and speaking on behalf of candidates. Why I'm not working on a campaign is because it's a full-time job, and I needed to have a job after the campaign, and there weren't any campaigns then, and the first job that I got was this, my TV job. And the other thing is, we don't want to, I never, if you notice in the book, I've for the last 14 years have worked on national politics. I have not worked in a state race since 1980. I don't go to states and live in the states. And that's what these 1994 races are about. So it would be kind of difficult in a brand new marriage for both of us to be living in different states, and not something we chose to do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where we're going with this, but and I'm working on these campaigns. I can no longer, now that I'm to do the way that Mary and I did campaigns, you have to throw your whole self in it. This is not something that you show up to for, 8, 9, 10 hours a day, and she goes and she does fundraisers, she stays involved, she has a show, I mean, we're doing a book and everything else. I mean, I wish I was in a position, but some of the best times in my life were when I could go in working for Governor Miller in 1990, or Senator Wofford in 1991, where I could actually move into the headquarters, I could give my whole self to it. Well, B, I have other responsibilities, I'm married now, and furthermore, I've become, as I've said any number of times before, I've become more of a character than a consultant. And just my presence in a campaign now becomes more disruptive than it is helpful.
It's more disruptive?
Sure. Can be very disruptive.
How so?
Well, people say, well, ask Carville. So everything the candidate says, and people on there say, well, Carville told him to say that. You know, I mean, because I've become, and largely at my own help in making, I've become, I've written a book on a presidential race. So it used to be that I could walk in, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would get in a campaign. I would look at the clips. I'd say, you know what I mean, make assignments, who we're going to do, what was our thing today, do a yellow pad out and do a to-do list and do all the kinds of things that good campaign managers would do. I would go out sometimes and see how the candidate was doing on the road and that type of stuff. But now, but people have started asking me questions about the book, and I understand that. My presence in a campaign is different than it used to be.
Well, this isn't all negative. We're making it sound
negative.
Yeah,
I'm not mad about it. Yeah.
I've been able to, thank goodness, knock on wood, raise some goodly amounts of money for candidates, which they desperately need. I mean, I can't go work, as James says, 80 hours a week, but I can go raise some money for them, which they need as much as they need people telling them.
I want to be clear. I'm not whining about this. The other thing is, I have a wife. I want to spend time with my wife. I don't want to move. I'm 50 years old. I mean, I don't want to go live in an apartment by myself and anywhere now for 2 or 3 months as I used to do. I mean, we've been very fortunate in this. I mean, so please, please don't think that we're complaining about this. It's just a fact of life.
You know what's hard for a lot of people to figure out, and I wouldn't ask this except that it's in part the subject of your book, is if you're both so diametrically opposed politically, it must be hard to have a relationship where you're not disagreeing all the time.
Well, no, don't talk about politics. It presumes that people
are... But politics is at the center of your lives.
Well, listen, we still work. I mean, I still hang out with all my Republican friends, and it takes a lot to get ready to go in and do these campaigns. I do a different speech for each campaign. I do a show every night in which I am not a talk show host or journalist. I'm a partisan. I always take the partisan point of view. The point of that being that all day long, I'm in my conservative world talking to my conservative friends and doing all the politics I want to do. When I come home, we do so many other things that we have in common. We run, we read, we love to read, we love to eat. We just don't need to do politics 24 hours a day. And if we know it's going to be a cause of consternation in our relationship, which we have proved repeatedly, we don't talk about it. We just avoid those areas that are going to cause discomfort to our relationship.
Jeez, I mean, if anything, I think it's helped it. I wouldn't want to go home, assume that I was married to someone who I was politically compatible with. And all that person wanted to talk about was politics. I mean, 14 hours a day, anything is enough.
The thing is, it's a worldview politics. It's everything from, it's what you believe about culture and issues.
We don't disagree, but there's plenty of issues that we agree on. It's just not, all I can say is we're very, very fortunate people. We had, like I said, we had a chance to do something that Mary's been able to work in presidential campaigns twice. We have very fortunate to be able to have written this book, and we're very fortunate in a lot of ways. And I think one of the things that actually what makes us fortunate is that we just, because we, if we get into sort of policy arguments about politics, we tend to end up in an argument. We just discussed the process of politics. We'll see this morning, we saw the vice president on TV talking about Haiti, and we were sort of commenting about
His presentation, his presence.
We could have very easily gotten into an argument about Haiti, but we could make the observation about it. We see some campaign do something. We'll say, well, that was smart what that person did or what this person didn't do. Or what do you think about that? I mean, I get this question a lot.
Let me interrupt if I can, going back to the worldview question, because implicit in that question is we must be hypocrites about our beliefs, otherwise, otherwise we'd be fighting all the time. The truth of the matter is, we very much disagree on economic policy. We have a very different view of the role of government in Americans' lives. But having said that, we are both cultural Catholics. We both come from loving families. We both believe that in public service, and we just think that, and we both believe in America, not to be goo-goo about this, in a better America. We just think there's different ways of getting there. That doesn't make us at odds with our worldview. Our worldview starts with the family, and it goes out from there, and we're both very blessed to have beautiful, loving families that we get to talk to every day and visit with. And one of the wonderful side effects of having some little financial security now for the first time in our lives is that we get to bring our families up here and see them more than we used to. So that's what our worldview is. I mean, we really don't sit around and talk about choice versus life, at the breakfast table. That's not how we get up in the morning.
It hasn't been. I mean, if we talk about it, we tend to, in the end, the conversation ends up into an argument, but we talk about it less and less because, frankly, we don't like to argue. if anybody that's married will tell you, it's just no fun arguing, and it's no fun going through the 15 minutes of, 2 hours it takes to get over the argument. So it's just like stick your hand in the fire for your child, as my uncle used to say. Well, don't tell him no, just let him stick it in there, and he burn it enough, he'll quit doing it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was fun.
Bye-bye.
Mary Madeline and James Carville are co-authors of a new memoir called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mark Danner arrived in Port-au-Prince last night, just in time, he thought, for the invasion. Coming up, we'll discuss what he found instead. Danner is reporting for The New Yorker. He's written about Haiti on and off since 1986. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Thousands of cheering and waving Haitians crowded the shores of Port-au-Prince today, welcoming American troops who were landing. U.S. troops are fanning out across the city, securing it for a peacekeeping force. They'll later spread into Haiti's interior to control the rest of the country. NPR's Michael Sullivan is in Port-au-Prince. He says the city is quiet.
It looks like a normal Monday here. There are plenty of people going to and from their jobs or their homes. The central market here appears to be fairly busy. The bus depot is not as busy. It was in the past few days when many people thought that there was going to be a hostile invasion here. There were lots of people who were trying to get out of town on the buses. They feared that the U.S. would come in here and destroy large parts of the city. There were far fewer people at the bus depot today trying to leave town. Everyone seems to have gotten the word. A lot of people listened to President Clinton's speech last night. It was broadcast live here on Voice of America with a Creole translation. So a lot of people got the word, and things seem very calm here at the moment.
NPR's Michael Sullivan. The director of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson, is worried about the future of Haitian democracy. He says Haiti's military leaders should be kicked out of the country and the army should be drastically cut back.
It is an army of 7,000 men soaking up 45% of the national budget, reaping $200 million a year in drug bribes in their role as a transshipment agent for drugs coming out of the cartels of Latin America into the United States.
Robinson had staged a hunger strike earlier this year when President Clinton sent Haitian refugees back to their country. He stopped doing that when Mr. Clinton arranged for the Haitians to be taken into other countries. The new Haitian accord comes nearly 1 year after military ruler General Raul Cedras reneged on a UN deal that would have had him step down and let President Jean-Bertrand Aristide resume power. The new agreement will force the junta to give up power as soon as the Haitian parliament passes an amnesty law to protect the coup leaders and their supporters from retribution. The agreement requires the junta leaders to step down by October 15th, no matter what. But the deal does not force Cedras to leave Haiti, nor does it mention him by name. He didn't sign the document. That was done by Haiti's de facto president, Emile Jonassin. Last year's UN amnesty plan had Haitian leader Cedras stepping down if he and the military were granted amnesty. But Cedras sent armed thugs to intimidate Haitian lawmakers. The Haitian parliament couldn't get enough lawmakers together to make a quorum, so that deal was blown, and Cedras did not step down. This time, Secretary of State Warren Christopher says leaders will be gone October 15th because the presence of 15,000 U.S. troops will help motivate Cedras to resign. On Wall Street, stocks were higher. The Dow rose 3.25 points to close at 3693. This is NPR. Firefighters in Idaho are holding firm against wildfires. Three major blazes in the state have consumed more than 400,000 acres, but none gained more ground over the weekend. The air is dry, but cooler temperatures have helped the firefighters. The crews are still cutting fire lines around the blazes, and they say most of the fires are about half encircled. Fire danger is still high, so there is worry that if the weather doesn't cooperate, there could be flare-ups in the week ahead. A new study indicates the U.S. has dramatically regained its leadership in many important technologies. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The Council on Competitiveness says American firms have improved dramatically in several important high-tech industries. The Council is a coalition of leaders from business, labor, and higher education. 3 years ago, the group issued a report warning that America's technological edge had eroded in one industry after another. But in a new study, the council talks of a dramatic comeback in several areas central to building the advanced communications networks dubbed the Information Superhighway. The report says a renewed emphasis on quality controls in manufacturing has boosted American engineering and production technologies, and that corporate reorganization has cut the time it takes to get new products to market. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
New York coroners are going to autopsy former tennis star Vitas Gerulaitis today. The 40-year-old star died yesterday. He was found at a home he was visiting in Southampton, New York. Police say there is nothing suspicious about his death. The New York Times is quoting Gerulaitis' sister as saying her brother apparently suffered a heart attack while he was sleeping. He had just competed in a tennis tournament in Seattle, but he was forced to pull out because of back pain. Again, on Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials rose more than 3 points to close at 3,936.72. Declining issues led advancers by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalists in Haiti are covering a different story than they expected. U.S. planes were in the air on their way to invade Haiti last night when the military rulers agreed to step down. The agreement was brokered by an American delegation headed by former President Jimmy Carter. Haitian military leaders Raoul Cedras and Philippe Biambi agreed to resign by October 15th in return for amnesty. They are not required to leave the country. Deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide will return to office when they step down. Earlier today, we spoke to Mark Danner in Port-au-Prince. He's reporting for The New Yorker and writing a book on Haiti. He's been covering that country on and off since 1986. Danner is also the author of the new book Massacre at El Mazote, about the U.S. cover-up of a massacre of peasants during the war in El Salvador. Danner spent most of the summer in Haiti. He returned to Port-au-Prince last night.
Coming in last night, we actually expected the invasion would be underway. And as your listeners know now, it had actually started in the evening and was called back. We heard on local radio stations as we were driving into a very darkened and deserted Port-au-Prince that was quite filled with what they call attachés here, or civilians, usually armed with either M16s or machetes. We heard as we were driving in that a deal had been reached, some sort of arrangement had been reached between the military government and the delegates sent by the Clinton administration. And the atmosphere in the city was very tense. There were a lot of armed people around. We didn't know the character of it until we actually arrived at the hotel and saw the address by the de facto president, Émile Jonassin, who addressed the nation and essentially said that the U.S. was on the verge of an invasion, and the military leaders have taken the honorable course to protect their country, have decided at some point, he didn't specify, to step down. He didn't mention President Aristide at all. And essentially said, you know, this will get the sanctions lifted immediately.
So were you stunned when you heard that?
I was rather surprised. And when I began to get an idea of the full dimensions of the agreement, I was quite surprised, frankly.
What surprised you most about the agreement?
Well, it seemed to me that the military here cut an extremely good deal for itself, a quite extraordinarily good deal for itself. And I was rather stunned at that. Not only are a number of questions, in many ways the most important questions, still open, but the sense building up over the last week, carefully built up really by the Clinton administration, that indeed we were on the verge of action, and that if indeed the military leaders did not leave forthwith, there would be action, was completely dissipated by this agreement. In fact, the tone changed 180 degrees to a tone of respect for the sense of patriotism and honor of the leaders that only a few hours before President Clinton had been denouncing as leaders of the bloodiest or most violent regime in the hemisphere. So it was, that was rather extraordinary, and even more extraordinary to me was the degree to which the key questions have been left open. The date, there's not a date certain, it seems to me, when President Aristide is to return It seems not at all certain that General Cedras, General Biambi, and Lieutenant Colonel Francois will leave the country. In fact, General Cedras, the 15th of October, which is the date he is to leave power, happens to fall 3 days after the legal date on which he would have been obliged to give up power anyway. That is the end of his three-year term. Finally, from a situation in which the army would have been demolished and then put back together in what one assumed would be a smaller, more constabulary-type force, which was the thought before, you know, concerning intervention, now the army is intact, and it's quite unclear to what degree the American army will be in a position to train it or to influence its structure or indeed to determine that it should be reduced in any substantial way. So all of these questions are completely open now, and it's interesting to me the way it reveals what was important on either side. I mean, it seems...
Well, what does it say to you about that?
Well, I think it says that the Clinton administration was desperate to avoid casualties and armed conflict. The administration, I think, knew that it was unpopular. It knew that it had very little political support in the country for it, and it knew that its only chance of carrying it off successfully was if, indeed, there were very few casualties. And if there were a lot of casualties, it knew that it would suffer political damage that might indeed be almost irretrievable for the administration. And essentially, they took this fear, and the Haitian military took this fear and bargained it and said, look, you don't want casualties, you know, we'll give you a face-saving way out, which essentially is what this is. We will let you come in peacefully, but in return, you have to not insist that we leave right away. You have to not give a date certain when Father Aristide will come back. And essentially, you have to leave open many of these political questions that have to be decided, like the future shape of the Haitian army. Now, so what you have is a new state of play when you'll have two armies in this country, the American and the Haitian. And the question will be this delicate political game between the Americans and the Haitians, trying to decide how much power the Americans have over the Haitians. And in that delicate game, I think the Haitians have certain cards to play, particularly the threat of violence, because any sort of widespread violence now will severely tarnish the diplomatic triumph, as the president is billing it, you know, that he claims to have brought to the situation. I mean, it sounds like I'm completely negative about it. I'm not completely negative about it, but I think it is quite extraordinary, the deal that the military was able to arrange for itself.
My guest is Mark Danner. He's in Port-au-Prince reporting for The New Yorker. He's writing a book about Haiti and is also the author of the new book about El Salvador, Massacre at El Mazote. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Mark Danner, who's in Port-au-Prince. What kind of reaction have you found today in your travels around Port-au-Prince?
Well, we began driving around quite early in the day as darkness started to lift over the city. And I really felt in the answers of a lot of people we spoke to a sense of bewilderment. People didn't know quite what to think. On the one hand, the Americans were coming in. On the other hand, coming in to help with the restoration of democracy, as it was phrased. On the other hand, those who had expelled the elected president were staying as well. I mean, now we'll start to have a number of questions. For example, will the American soldiers act in some way to disarm the attachés, the armed civilians, paramilitary forces here? Will they take up positions in Cité Soleil, La Soline, Carrefour Faye, and the other popular slum areas of the city that have been the center or the base of Father Aristide's support. Will they in some way interpose themselves between the forces of Aristide and the attachés? I mean, will they become involved in that or not? That question was asked directly to General Hugh Shelton, who's the commander of the mission, at a press conference this morning at the American consulate. And the general really ducked the question. You know, he said, we're still working on that one. So it's quite unclear to me what role the Americans will take. And obviously, it's probably unclear to them as well at the moment. I mean, I'm sure they're trying to decide that now. These aren't technical matters. They're really deeply political ones.
Have you met with the military leaders like Cedras?
Yes. Uh-huh.
What are your impressions of him? Maybe you could give us a little profile of him and tell us something about the interactions you've had with him.
Well, General Cedras is grew up in the southern city of Jérémy, which is a somewhat proud, rather isolated place with a very impressive history. It's nicknamed the City of Poets. Lovely place on the end of the southern peninsula. Very strong mulatto stronghold since before the revolution, the Haitian Revolution. General Cedras, as you know, is light-skinned. His father was a Duvalier official, a mayor, equivalent of a mayor in the area. On the other hand, on his mother's side, you had people who were quite anti-Duvalier. So he had he's somewhat a divided character, I would say. Very intense, somewhat, definitely thinks of himself very much as an intellectual. He was first in his class in the military academy in 73. Which was the hand-picked class called the Promotion Jean-Claude Duvalier. It was a very elite class picked from sons of Duvalier officials. He was first in his class, as I said. He had later was the commander or director of the military academy. He's not really a leader of troops at all. His signal achievement, actually, and ironically enough, was holding the 1990 election in which Father Aristide was elected president. He was in charge of security for that. And because of the background of the difficulties in holding elections in Haiti since 1986, one of which I alluded to a minute ago, the 87 fiasco, this was a very, very difficult job. And he was thought to have carried it off with great finesse and ability, which is one of the reasons why President Aristide put so much trust in him and indeed appointed him commander-in-chief of the Haitian Armed Forces. He's a very proud man, somewhat distant, as I said, somewhat an intellectual, sort of something of a bureaucrat, I would say, in the sense that he's fascinated by the way organizations are made up. I think he had great hopes of changing and renovating the army when he came to power in June of 1991. To some degree, I think there's a sense, although this story was put out a lot and one isn't really sure, but I think there is a sense in which he was put in the position he was in at the beginning. I'm not sure I've ever believed that he was the initiator of the coup itself, although many people believe he was, including Father Aristide, apparently.
Aristide has himself been accused of human rights violations and of threatening the middle class. From your experience with him, do you think those charges are true?
Well, Aristide is a complicated, fascinating man, and he's an enormously potent political threat to a lot of people here. This isn't really a question about Father Aristide himself at all, frankly. It's a question about how politics have developed here, in particular since 1986, when a popular movement, in some sense, set the stage for the overthrow of the dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier. After Jean-Claude Duvalier left aboard an American jet, there was a few days of some of it quite brutal retribution. members of his militia force, the Tonton Macoute. Some of them were macheted to death, burned, killed in various ways. The army stood aside. At various other points in during the years since, when there have been coup d'etats and overthrows of government, of which there have been several, I think there have been seven rulers since 1986, you've had spasms of similar behavior, retribution. People have been killed, particularly in neighborhoods like Cité Soleil and La Saline, slum neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. Father Aristide is a populist priest, very, very popular, obviously, who had his start preaching in Saint-Jean Bosco, which is a church on the edge of La Saline, one of the biggest slums in the city. And throughout his career, since 1986, he's been somewhat ambiguous on the subject of popular retribution. On the one hand, he preaches justice, human rights, freedom. On the other hand, he's been loath to denounce the people. And even when their behavior is attacking enemies during periods of political uproar, even when people are lynched in the neighborhoods, Macoutes and so on, he's found it very difficult politically, and I think personally to some extent too, to denounce this sort of behavior. When he became president, he found himself with a very difficult political problem. He was elected with 67% of the vote. 2 out of 3 Haitians voted for him. On the other hand, a great many, probably the great majority of those who were powerful in the country, the rich and the middle class which has controlled the army and the bureaucracy, the government, for the last 45, 50 years, voted against him. So he was very much the representative of the masses. During his term in office, those groups who were against him used their control of the bureaucracy, of the parliament, of the army to block many of his initiatives. And the degree to which he was blocked in the institutions of government, he appealed more and more to the streets, to his supporters, to his masses in the streets. This was an enormous threat to people, this image of burning, déchouquéing is the phrase, uprooting. It was an enormous threat to those who have always held power here, the rich, and the middle class as well. Before he actually was inaugurated, there was an attempted coup against him on January 7th, 1991, led by a Macoute, famous Duvalierist figure named Roger Lafontaine. After the army put it down, his supporters, Aristide supporters, that is, surged into the streets and killed a great many of Lafontaine's supporters. They burned the old cathedral in Port-au-Prince. They roughed up the papal nuncio. The hierarchy was perceived to be very anti-Duvalierist. And those images of popular action and of mass retaliation, I think, were indelibly imprinted on people's minds here. So on the one hand, a lot of what is said about Aristide and human rights violations are enormously exaggerated. There's no question that the human rights situation while he was in office was better than it was before he came to office, and certainly much better than the regime that followed him, that expelled him. On the other hand, these images of the masses attacking people, of street justice, were indelibly imprinted on people's minds. And I think, in a way, it's their projection of what they saw as the future, what they feared would be the future under a President Aristide if he weren't removed from power.
My guest is Mark Danner. He's in Port-au-Prince reporting for The New Yorker. He's writing a book about Haiti and is also the author of the new book about El Salvador, Massacre at El Mazote. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, let me guess, maybe something on Haiti tonight?
I would say so, yes. What we're trying to do is take as good a look, as provide as good an update as we can of everything that we know about Haiti from the time that we go on the air with All Things Considered, and then we'll continually refresh the information. We have 3 people on the ground in Haiti. Michael Sullivan, Alan Tomlinson, and David Malpas went in with the troops. We will also be looking for the political reaction to Elizabeth Arnold, to the White House and what happened there, to Mar-a-Liason. Ted Clark is looking out for the State Department. We have a variety of commentators, and we'll just keep on the story.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is journalist Mark Danner. He's in Port-au-Prince. What was it like to watch the troops begin to arrive today? And did you see any lawlessness in the streets?
Well, there was not any lawlessness in the streets, but I must tell you that seeing the troops arrive was a deeply affecting experience for me. I've been coming here. I began coming to Haiti right after the fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier, when there was this period of enormous hope that, you know, a dictatorship had ended. There would be democracy now, a new Haiti. It was really an inspiring time to be here. And in a sense, coming down knowing that there were going to be American troops here, I had this feeling of, goodness, this is a logical conclusion to this process, and how saddening it is that this is the conclusion, you know, an American invasion. But standing out there on the tarmac at the airport, I had quite a different feeling. The helicopters came down. They came in formation over the airport, over the mountains above Port-au-Prince, and came down, and you had to think of Apocalypse Now. You know, that's exactly what it looked like. And they swooped down in very impressive fashion, landed simultaneously, 10 of them, on the runway. The soldiers charged out and took up combat positions on the runway around the helicopters. Two beats later, the helicopters took off again, and the soldiers were left in clumps, you know, with their rifles pointing all around them on the runway. And the only enemy in sight, of course, was the press corps looking on from the balcony of the airport. And there was something so touching and absurd about this that I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And I just had to think that what a country this is, that every time you think there's going to be a conclusion of some sort, every time you think there's going to be a step that will irrevocably send it in some direction that can be counted on as positive or as negative at least, it will somehow conspire to make of something that seems to be direct and decisive something amorphous, nebulous, and absolutely impossible to grasp. And that seems to me what's happened here over the last couple of days. It seemed to be the Americans were going to move in, wipe out the dictator, and try to build a new country. And of course, over the last couple of days, we've gotten into quite a different situation, the result of which is very, very difficult to judge. And I couldn't help thinking that as I saw these soldiers in their battle positions on the runway, pointing their guns at no one around. What in the world have we gotten ourselves into, and what will be the future of Haiti with its American guests now?
Mark, we got to let you go. You've got a phone that's very coveted right now. There's a lot of journalists looking for telephones. So we'll let you go. Thank you so much for calling us and talking with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Danner is reporting on Haiti for The New Yorker and is writing a book about Haiti. He's also the author of the new book, Massacre at El Mazote. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A recent study found that as young girls reach adolescence, their self-esteem plummets. On the next Fresh Air, young girls, self-esteem, and the confidence gap. We talk with journalist Peggy Ornstein about her study of junior high school girls, comparing the problems of suburban and inner city students. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.